Coming up, got a loaded episode with S. Barahini talking about the play-in, previewing the NBA playoffs, and then talking about the latest news that's coming up next. Welcome back to the Evan O'Connor Show. We got a good one today talking about the play-in games, previewing some of the playoff series with S. Barahini. S, what's up, man?
What's going on, man? How you doing? Thank you for having me on the show.
Appreciate it. I'm excited to have you joining us from The Athletic, NBA Daily, and Raptors Republic. Let's start off talking about the Warriors and Grizzlies play-in game that we saw on Tuesday night. 121-116 win for the Warriors. Butler was like the starter of this game, I felt like. Yes, he had 38 points, 12 of 20. And then Steph was the closer, like a baseball closer. 38 points for the game. He scored 15 of the Warriors' final 19 points in the game and hit some classic Steph shots coming off of movement off ball, these back-breaking shots that you're like, oh, we did everything possible. And the game ended with a five-second violation by the Grizzlies because they actually had a chance to tie it. Oh, my God. That was an awesome game to watch, except for a lot of the refereeing. But we'll ignore that for a minute. It was a great basketball game.
It was a great basketball game. And you know what? That five-second call, initially when I watched it, I was like, that can't be 5 seconds. There was no way that was 5 seconds. But you go back and you watch it, and eventually, it was a five-second call, fair and square. There was a lot of crazy calls in that. The Brandon Pajimski block that should have been a clean, no contact on that at all. It was a clean block. Someone said it was like one of the great. It was an incredible play. It was the white version of the LeBron James block in the sense that he got the thing. It was incredible to see. Pajimski did that, and it was basically a foul call, which was tough. There was a lot of weird calls throughout this game. I thought, for overall, the main thing, you mentioned it, but Jimmy just getting to the line consistently, 18 free throws in this one. The Warriors in general, before Jimmy came onto this team, was not a team that got to the free throw line a ton. They have been a free throw machine ever since. And that's the main difference with this team offensively that you catch in this game specifically. It's just they can batter teams, get to the rim constantly. And now there's this changeup of, okay, we can go to a Jimmy Butler-led lineup where he's out there doing his thing, and this is a different look for them offensively versus this is a Steph Curry-led lineup. And, they're doing their usual thing where they're trying to hunt out offensive matchups for him off ball and get him roaming and the clear-cut way Steph likes to play basketball. But they also have that matchup together where they dominate and they run these post-split actions with Draymond Green, and you have to basically pick your poison. And that's where this Warriors team is at its best. So it was showing off the full potential of the Dubs. That's what was most exciting about this game for me.
Yeah, for sure. I think it did show off their upside, especially with some of the actions that you're referencing in that fourth quarter involving Steph, Draymond, and Butler, getting all of them involved in the play, with the result usually being the pass being thrown towards Stephen Curry and him hitting jumpers. I felt like, Memphis, on one hand, Zach Edey, 17 rebounds in the game. The size advantage that he presented was pretty clear. On the other hand, Jaren Jackson Jr. getting out-rebounded by virtually everybody. It seems like on social media, there's a lot of blame towards Edey and not a lot of blame towards Jaren Jackson, who did not get into the paint and take advantage of his size. And Edey didn't either. Edey was only 4 of 11 in the game, missed a lot of bunnies at the rim. But I felt Golden State, if you're poking holes here when you look ahead to the series against Houston, the size of Şengün and Adams, I would expect, would present more issues than Edey and Jackson did, because Jackson in that game was really disappointing to me. He didn't look like a guy that even belonged in the All-NBA conversation. If you only watch that one game, you'd be like, yeah, he's okay. He's fine. He's a big guy who can shoot threes. He plays like a 6'2" guy, though.
Yeah, it was strange, because I thought this was a really impressive season from Jaren Jackson. The way that he improved as a post scorer, the way that he had improved as an isolation scorer, we didn't see any of that, Kevin, in this game. No. We didn't see any of it. And that was what was really disappointing. You couldn't take advantage. You couldn't put pressure on the Warriors defense in the paint. And I know people go towards Edie because, especially in that first half, the Warriors were just consistently hunting him, looking for him in pick and rolls, basically trying to get him off ball, running around. It worked. The Warriors
spent
did great
a lot
offense.
Of time on Butler. And I don't think that's Edie's fault that he's told to switch on to Jimmy Butler. That's a coaching decision, not Edie's fault.
Yeah, exactly. 100%. It 100% is. But they somewhat adjusted in the second half. And I thought Edie had a much stronger second half because they were pre-switching some of those actions, making it so that it's a little easier for him to live in the paint. That was what popped to me. And it's like, all right, you see, Zach Edie is a rookie. This is a guy who's playing his first real meaningful basketball game in the NBA. Jaren Jackson Jr. is at this point a veteran in the NBA, former defensive player of the year, a guy who is likely going to make an all-NBA team, a guy who's going to make a lot of money this summer. And he didn't show up in this game. He hit one big shot in the fourth quarter, but I think outside of that, he felt very, very invisible on both sides of the ball.
Yeah, he was getting back cut on defense too. Yeah. I mean, look, he's an all-defensive player. He's a former defensive player of the year. He did not look like it against Golden State. He just didn't look like it, and that's what they needed, because I thought ultimately, look, Edie didn't score the way they would have liked to, but 17 boards, he was a deterrent at times when he was around the basket, when he was able to stay near the paint. Edie did his job. Yeah. Morant turns his ankle in the third quarter after a great Grizzlies run. He comes back. He plays pretty well. He's definitely fighting out there. Ja did his job. He had a really good game. Desmond Bane, who's been on a tear ever since the coaching change, running like triple the amount of pick and rolls per game. He was on fire, scoring from the floor, scoring from three, getting into the paint. He had a great game. The role players, Aldama had his first good game in a long while. Conchar had good minutes. Like Scottie Pippen did solid against Steph. Like, not the best you can do, but he did solid. Almost everybody, I felt like, did their job on Memphis, except Jaren Jackson Jr. And that's where it's like, if you're a Grizzlies fan, you're like, damn, we got everything except from our best player all year long.
Right. Yeah, totally. Like, this is their guy. This is what they were expecting would take them over the top in certain situations and just wasn't like that. And you know what? Like, that's why there's so much pressure on Edie, because they struggled to keep Jaren at the five. And so you had to put Edie on the floor, because they needed those double big lineups. Whereas if they put Jaren on the floor, they were getting out rebounded like crazy. They weren't basically doing anything offensively to get him touches in the paint area. So that's why you saw so much pressure on Edie to do what he had to do too. Also, they were missing Brandon Clark in this. Like, I think Brandon Clark would have been a pretty, pretty important piece to this. Matt Moore tweeted this last night, but Clark is an 11.6 net rating against the Warriors this season. So clearly a very important guy. Also Jalen Wells, who unfortunately broke his wrist. But those are two guys that would have helped a lot in that game last night.
Yes, for sure. I mean, like you mentioned the rebounding. Moses Moody finished with three rebounds. It felt like he had 30. They were just such big boards that he had in those moments. Like the gang rebounding from Golden State, they did a really good job. And that's what they're going to have to do against Houston. So we can kind of turn to the 2-7 series now that we know Houston and Golden State will be facing off. I mentioned this in passing earlier. Edie, the rebounding did show how Golden State lacks the size necessary to keep a guy like that off the boards. Jackson, on the other hand, showed how, you know, he's not able to use his size to his advantage. But for Houston, that Şengün Adams lineup this season, I wonder how much we're going to see it against Golden State, because on one hand, you could say the Warriors will shred them to death. They have all this outside shooting. They're going to play fast. They'll bring those guys out to the perimeter and exploit a too big lineup. But on the other hand, you look at the success Adams and Şengün have had this season, plus 29.9 net rating in 162 minutes. They grabbed 51.4% of offensive board opportunities when they're on the floor. And even in the lineups with just Adams, it's like well over 40%. It's one of the greatest offensive rebounding seasons we've ever seen. Thinking Basketball made a video about him recently, and it's just like spot on. Adams had an unbelievable permanent year on the boards, and it's part of what makes Houston's offense so effective in those non-Şengün minutes or the minutes with Şengün. So I think for Golden State, the real key to the series, the real swing factor, in my opinion, we know that they're going to do everything possible to get Steph going. They're going to do everything possible to get Amen Thompson off of him and all that. We'll talk about that in a second, but controlling the boards is going to be of the utmost importance. I don't think Şengün or Adams are going to go 4 of 11 on shots right at the rim.
Yeah, I agree with you. And like, if you look at the way those Şengün Adams, the reason that that thing works offensively is because they generate so many offensive rebounds. Like they have 122 offensive rating with those two together. And part of that is just because they crash the offensive glass like crazy. And they're able to just get more opportunities than the other team. To your point, I wonder how often we see that lineup, because it's something they've tried relatively recently. You mentioned, I think it was like 162 minutes together. That feels like it's a new thing for me. I've really only seen it post trade deadline, post All-Star break, them really trying to lean into this double big lineup of Şengün and Adams. And I guess the question you have is, all right, how much are you going to put Adams in space? How much are you going to put Şengün in space and see how he can work with either Jimmy or Steph Curry working in isolation to try and score against them? Warriors aren't a heavy isolation team, but if they go at Şengün and Adams the way that they did Edie in that first half, it could spell trouble for the Rockets. That said, like, even one of Adams or Şengün are really great offensive rebounders. They crash the glass, they play much bigger, and like you said, they finish in and around the basket more. I think my question is, like, how are those two going to look offensively putting pressure on the Warriors on the inside, right? Because yes, Golden State has Draymond Green. Yes, they're able. Like, are they going to have to put Looney out there? Looney did not look that great last night in the minutes that he played. Is he going to have to be a part of their rotation next season? Are we going to see Jonathan Kuminga just from a size perspective? Does the Warriors' rotation change now because they're playing a much bigger team?
You know, that part's going to be interesting, because if you look at the last Houston Golden State matchup when Steph had 3 points and Amen Thompson just shut the water off for him, it was one of the most dominant individual defensive performances of the entire season, what Amen Thompson did against Steph. In that game, I felt like Şengün scored on whoever they put on him. Against Draymond, Şengün felt too big, too strong. And then against Looney, he was too quick. And so for Golden State, Draymond is going to have a monster series defending Şengün, because I don't think Looney is going to be able to elevate to the level necessary to contain a borderline all-NBA guy or potentially an all-NBA guy in Şengün. So that's a question there. On the defensive side, you mentioned, how much are they going to try to pull Şengün and Adams out to the perimeter? I'm sure they're going to try to do it a lot, because they're going to try to get Amen Thompson off of Steph, try to get Dylan Brooks off of Jimmy Butler. But like, this is like a lot of names. Fred VanVleet did really well against Steph in the past Raptors finals. Granted, there's injuries on the Warrior side, but VanVleet did well in the past. Dylan Brooks has done well against Stephen Curry as well. Amen Thompson, as I just said, had one of the better games. He's been one of the better Steph defenders ever since he entered the NBA, especially this year in his second year. So they have a lot of guys they can throw at Steph, a lot of guys they can throw at Butler. And even if their bigs are pulled out to the perimeter, they just have a flat-out better defense than Memphis. Memphis's defense stinks. So, like, you have size. Yeah. You have Jabari Smith and Tari Eason on the back line to help. I feel a hell of a lot better about Houston's ability to support a big pulled out on the perimeter than Edie on an island against Jimmy Butler. Like, he's hopeless. But Şengün and Adams, they have support behind them that makes me feel a lot better about Houston in this series.
The thing that catches my eye with the Rockets defense is just how great they are at recovering out. And they're so good at springing into action. So if there is some sort of lapse defensively, you mentioned it, Thompson is one of the best at kind of getting into that area where he can just cause havoc. Same thing with Dylan Brooks, who does a great job at the point of attack. I have a stat here. So the Rockets are the fourth best team at defending cuts in the NBA. They generate or allow only 1.24 points per possession on cuts. And that's one of the best in the NBA this season. So I think obviously the Warriors are a great cutting team. They use split actions to get Jimmy and Steph going a lot. That's something that I think will be a question in this series, just because of how great the Rockets are at occupying space off of the ball and roaming around, especially Amen Thompson. How the Warriors are able to get advantages for their guys, especially Steph, off the ball. That's the question that I have with this Rockets team. The other thing I wanted to ask you, Kevin, all right? So this Warriors defense has been legit, right? Number one since they added Jimmy Butler. They've been awesome at defending. And the Rockets generally have not been a good clutch time team. They're 18th in offensive rating, 19th in fourth quarter net rating. The Warriors, on the other hand, seventh best offense, first best defense, fourth best net rating in that fourth quarter. You look at Steph Curry and what he did last night versus the Grizzlies. You have a guy who you can rely on every single time. And I think this will be one of those series where every game is going to go down to the wire. Every game is going to be very close because the Rockets' defense will keep them at a striking distance. The Warriors' defense will find a way to work. And generally, it's going to be a lot of close games. How are the Rockets going to score in the fourth quarter? That's the main question that I have for this team offensively.
Yes, and that is 100% the primary concern with Houston, because even in their games that they, you know, win against Golden State this year, they're scoring just in the 100s. They're holding Golden State to 90. Can you do that over a seven-game series?
Exactly.
It's going to be the big question. And so, I mean, for Houston, man, look, if they lose this series, or even if they win and they lose in round two, I think no matter what, the story about Houston entering this offseason will be, well, how do you add more scoring? Because I don't think they're going to win the finals. Like, I don't think they're going to 0-4 Pistons their way to an NBA Finals trophy at the end of the year, hoisting it up Fred VanVleet and Jabari Smith and Dylan Brooks, all these guys. I just don't see it happening. I think some of the other teams are just flat out better, but their defense is legit. But can they score enough?
I don't know, man.
You don't think so?
It's tough. I don't think they can. And like, yeah, exactly. Rockets fans have to deal with Steph Curry. That's the way that it's going to go in this series. And you know how Steph lights up when he plays in Houston. Mm-hmm. I think that's a big, big factor. There's a lot of history there between both of these teams, which, you know, I don't want to get into the missed threes part of it, but that's just
0 for 27. Yeah. Poor Rockets.
0 for 27, man.
Think about that. You know that highlight's going to be played on the broadcast at some point.
Can you imagine going through an entire rebuild and then getting back to the playoffs only to have to face Steph Curry again? That's wild.
The one name we haven't mentioned, we talk about Şengün with what he needs to bring. We haven't talked about Jalen Green, who's had some major highs this season. Stretches of averaging over 25, almost 30 points per game. Super efficient. Where's your trust level in Jalen Green in his first playoff experience?
We'll see is my trust level. I think this is going to be an awesome learning experience for Jalen Green, just because defenses will be keyed in on him for a whole seven-game series, and especially this Warriors defense, who I don't think is the greatest point-of-attack defense, but between Moses Moody and Gary Payton II, like, they have guys that they can throw at the point of attack to make things tough on Jalen Green. You look at, like, what Jalen did in their last matchup, he was awesome in that second half. He just caught fire, shot tons of threes, was creating off of the bounce. That's the version of Jalen Green this Rockets team needs against the Warriors. Like, they need him to be a guy who's aggressive, who's hunting out his own shot, who's saying, hey, this is my turn to kind of make my name here in the NBA, and I'm going to make the most of this opportunity. This is a big, big pressure point for Jalen Green right now. Can you take that next step in your career? Can you be a guy who can lead a playoff team as their number one scorer? Or are you going to struggle under the lights, right?
So Vegas has Golden State favored as of now, and we'll see how that changes before game one on Sunday.
Interesting.
I'm a little surprised that Golden State's so heavily favored as a 7 over 2. I feel like Houston has played Golden State very well this season. We just saw a couple weeks ago what Amen Thompson did to Stephen Curry, harassing him all game, holding him to only 3 points, super inefficient. He's been good against Steph in every matchup this year. And again, a 7-game series of playoff intensity is different than regular season games. Golden State is going to be game planning to take him away. But you know this, covering the Raptors, what happened in the finals in 19? It was a lot of attention on Stephen Curry, making everybody else beat you. And with Houston and Udoka's defense and the amount of bodies they can throw at Stephen Curry, my guess is we're going to see a hell of a lot of tension at Stephen Curry trying to make literally everybody else beat you, which I think makes it a Jimmy Butler series. Will Jimmy Butler be able to step up and have high 30s or high 20s like he did in the play-in game? Or will he just fade away like he did in that matchup against Houston, where they needed that secondary score and he didn't bring it? So that I think Butler's going to have to be the guy who has a massive series in order to get through Houston, which is funny because like Houston was the team everybody was talking about maybe trading for Jimmy Butler. And then he goes to Golden State. Hometown kid, right? So here we are with these two teams matching up. So I think that's going to be one of the keys here. You mentioned Kuminga as well. Will he play in the series? Will they need his athleticism? Of course, this year, he's not playing for a reason. They're minus 6.1 in minutes that Kuminga and Butler share the floor. When it's just Jimmy out there with any other lineup, they're plus 10.8 net rating. So they've been bad with Kuminga out there. I do wonder if we'll see him at some point. And I think we will see him at some point because my series prediction is Houston in six. I'm taking Houston in the series. And I think we're going to see some changes from Golden State throughout the series in order to match the youth and the athleticism and the energy that the Houston Rockets defense brings. I'm really a believer in Houston's defense. And with Golden State, I do worry about them having enough shooting around Stephen Curry. It's a lot to ask from Steph in a series. And look, we'll see. They have a lot of bodies that can throw Jimmy Butler as well. So that's my prediction. Houston in six. What do you got, S?
I like that. I like it. I agree that it's going to be a long series because I think people are discrediting the Rockets a little bit too much. They played awesome basketball to finish this season. They've obviously been like an incredible defense. So you don't want to discredit that aspect of this team. And I think they will pose some challenges for the Warriors. I'm going to go ahead and say Warriors in seven. I think it will be a very, very close series. And maybe that's a cop-out answer, to be honest with you, because seven-game series, you never know how it's going to go. But Warriors in seven feels like the pick for me just because, look, when it comes down to it, when it comes down to the fourth quarter, and like I said, I think there's going to be a lot of close games in this series where the deciding factor will be who ends up being more clutch, who ends up, you know, having that gene. And I just trust Steph Curry and Jimmy Butler more than I do Jalen Green or Şengün or Fred VanVleet. I've seen the Rockets really wither in those type of situations all season. And I think that's the thing that I'm expecting to be their Achilles heel in this playoff series as well. So I'm going to go with Warriors in seven. Would not be surprised if the Rockets end up, you know, shocking the world here and pulling off what feels like an upset at this point, according to bettors. But yeah, I think that's where I would go. Warriors in seven.
Well, Warriors-Grizzlies felt like it was a different league than the other play-in game that we saw.
Yeah, yeah.
Between the Magic and the Hawks, it's hard to believe it's the same sport. Magic won the game 120-95, just a completely different level of basketball with the earlier game compared to the later the game in the night. You made a couple posts about this throughout the night. What do you think was the strangest or worst defensive decision by Atlanta in that game against Orlando?
Yeah, so they were basically just they were showing so many bodies at Paolo Banchero and saying, all right, we're going to double you off the catch. If you catch it in the post, we're doubling you immediately. Even on the perimeter, if it's a pick and roll, we're shading your pick and rolls. We're not letting you drive. And I guess that makes a lot of sense if Paolo didn't play for the Orlando Magic, because the Magic are the worst three-point shooting team in the league. They shoot 30% from three this season. They have not been good at capitalizing on the advantages that Paolo and Franz Wagner create. And so the Hawks kind of played right into their hands, where Paolo was able to be a facilitator. I think he had 5 assists in that first quarter, ended up with 7 overall. He was a guy who basically could manipulate and bend the Hawks defense to his will. He got to the free throw line a ton too, just because of that extra pressure and extra kind of body around lingering around him. So that's why the Hawks lost this game. It was just you created this situation for yourself in the first half and then created a disadvantage to that. When Atlanta tried to get back in that third quarter, it was too big of a deficit to catch up.
Yeah, I felt like, you know, it was Atlanta trying to be what Orlando is with their physicality and their toughness and their rotations. Because Orlando's defense, despite all the injuries they've had, they still get a lot of guys on that defense. And holding Atlanta to 95 is, you know, not an easy task. Atlanta can still get buckets despite, you know, the fact they're just a below average team. I felt like Trey, I mean, he gets himself thrown out, kicks the ball, you know, gets 2 techs in the game. His quote after the game, it was funny. The quote after the game, did you see what he said about Orlando?
I actually didn't see that. No.
He said, obviously they're a physical team. I mean, I've had two teammates hurt this year in one game against them. Like, I'm not going to call them dirty players or anything like that. I think they have a lot of talented players. Just feels like sore loser energy. The way he gets himself thrown out, ejected from the game. The quote after the game, not going to say they're dirty players. Just felt like sour grapes. Again, from Trey, it was a bad display from him. You're Trey Young. You're a superstar level player. You have a huge following, like people who just love Trey Young. Not even just Hawks fans, but people who are Trey fans. And just, again, like it just feels like a lot of sore loser energy from Trey Young. And in some ways, I feel bad, though, because I've been really critical of Trey over the years. I've been critical of the fact, you know, that not only is he small, at one point he didn't give great effort defensively. I feel like that's improved. Pre-DeJounte Murray, I used to criticize him for not moving enough off ball. He'd stand at half court. He got a bit better at that under Quinn Snyder when DeJounte Murray was his teammate. He's been adaptable. He undoubtedly makes his teammates better as a playmaker. He solved some of my concerns. So in some ways, I feel bad that he's gotten better, and yet he's still stuck in this situation. But then you see stuff like last night, and I'm just like, damn, is he just reverting back to some of those old bad habits? Like some of this just feels self-imposed by Trey.
I agree to a certain extent, but also I did not think he needed to be ejected from that game. There was the post-game quote from the referee saying that it was part of the magic of the game or something along the lines of that. He ruined the spirit of basketball by faking out the referee.
The announcers were like, don't do that, kids. Don't do what he did.
I don't understand why he got ejected for that. I mean, look, maybe it was just the fact that Trey was being annoying all game.
Well, it was his second official tech, right? So that's why, yeah. Right? So technically, I mean, yeah. I understand. Shouldn't them. He put himself in position to get a tech.
Fair enough. Yeah, you're right. I with Trey and the Hawks, I think just generally basketball-wise, they were missing Jalen Johnson a lot in this game. Like that size, physicality on the help side, that's the exact type of guy you needed against the Magic. I like what this Hawks team is building generally with Reese Hoshea and Daniels and the amount of size that they have on the wings. But yeah, it all comes down to Trey. It all comes down to Trey and the way that he's able to, you know, kind of be that guy for them in these moments. And yeah, you can't have that happen to your leader of your team.
Yeah, I do feel like Atlanta's starting to trend up. You know, Reese Hoshea obviously had an unbelievable second half of the season, shot the hell out of it. Dyson Daniels might be the most improved player. He is receiving defensive player of the year votes. He'll undoubtedly be an all defensive guy. Okongwu improving offensively as well. He's extended his range to be a more competent three-point shooter. There's good things happening in Atlanta.
Yeah.
So there's positive things happening for them, and we'll see if they end up facing off against Chicago or Miami in the play-in game for the 8 seed for the opportunity to get roasted by the Cavaliers. The Magic, they get the 7 seed, and they're going to get roasted by the Celtics. With all the injuries Orlando had this year, all their absences, they're just not equipped to win a series against the Boston Celtics. There's no doubt about that. But with Orlando, is there anything you want to see from Banchero and Wagner? Like, what do you want to see from them, S, to feel better about what they can be in the long term leading the Magic?
So it's kind of related to this play-in game where Paolo did not have a good game from the field. It was like 3 of 11, just really wasn't able to get to his mid-range bag at all. I kind of want to figure out a way for Paolo to be more aggressive, get to the basket. Obviously, he draws free throws incredibly well, but also leveraging that free throw ability to finish in and around the basket, to be able to get to that mid-range shot, just becoming a more refined offensive player. And for Franz, I think Orlando, they don't get Franz involved enough. There is this sort of thing similar to Jaren Jackson, whereas like sometimes you feel like Franz is invisible in a game, and you want to be able to have him show off what he can do as a driver, as a guy who can facilitate the ball, a guy who can create his own shot. He's such a strong player too. And I think there's a really, really great test in front of them versus Boston, because you have sort of the, you know, a lot of people do the comparison of Franz and Paolo to Brown and Tatum. There's like the prototype versus the official version of it, right? And I really think that this is a good test for them to see, all right, what are we capable of offensively? These two stars who probably could have had contentions to be an all-NBA team player this season, I think, if they really played healthy the entire year. That's kind of the thing that I'm looking for. And then it's, can Boston's second best defense in the NBA put any sort of pressure on the Celtics? The Celtics have been so good at carving up basically everybody. They're a machine at this point in terms of creating open looks for themselves. But the size, the physicality of Orlando, can they put enough pressure on Boston to steal a game? That's basically the question I have
for it. I think so too. Can they steal one? Or for some of the other teams in the Eastern Conference, is there anything that Orlando does defensively that shows a blueprint to contain or slow down Boston's offense later in the playoffs? Because they hold Atlanta to only 4 made three-pointers. And of course, it's, you know, make or miss. But it was 4 made threes. There's only 13 instances in which a team made 4 or fewer threes throughout the entire regular season. And Boston had their two lowest three-point output games of the season against Orlando. Context matters here. In April, they had only 7 three-pointers against the Magic. No starters played in the game. In December, the Celtics had only 8 three-pointers against Orlando. Tatum didn't play that game. But the defensive scheme is the defensive scheme. And so I wonder if there's anything we see from Orlando in this series that shows, A, you know, hey, we can do this against high-powered offenses in the years to come as the Orlando Magic, as we get, you know, better balance, we add scoring, yada, yada, yada. But also for other teams like Cleveland, potential finals matchups, maybe a series against the Knicks or Pistons in round 2. Is there anything that those teams can glean from what Orlando does? With that said, though, taking Celtics in 4, I don't think the Magic are going to steal one in this game. I think it's going to be an eye-opening experience for Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner, and will be important lessons learned for young guys like that.
Yeah, I agree with you. Celtics in 4, I think this is a pretty easy decision here. They might be able to steal a game here if Orlando just catches fire and there's a crazy Cole Anthony game or something like that, but I wouldn't think they would push this to 6. It's pretty easily Celtics in 4, even despite the Jaylen Brown knee issues. I don't know how you feel about this. I've mentioned this on our podcast at the Athletic NBA Daily, but I think they should rest Jaylen Brown for round 1. They have nothing to lose here. They will beat Orlando even without Jaylen Brown. Give him that week or two off and have him prepped for the second round. I think that's the way. Like, I don't know. How do you feel about that? That kind of feels like a way to get Jaylen Brown at least a little bit more rest for the type of player that you need him to be in the second round and onwards.
I said the same exact thing.
Oh, really?
He should rest the whole first round. Unless in case of emergency, which I don't think there will be in an emergency for the Celtics with Jaylen Brown. I think he should rest. And I'm glad for Boston that he rested the remainder of the regular season instead of trying to get a 65. Yeah. He wasn't going to make all NBA. The real reward for him is another championship. That's what's going to improve your legacy the most. Another chance at another finals MVP potentially for him. Who knows if he could have a big finals again as well. So look, for Jaylen Brown, I think he should rest up. And even in the series against Orlando, maybe even a minutes restriction, but rest seems to be what I would expect would be best for him in that series. They have enough. Porzingis is healthy right now. He's been playing unbelievable basketball. They have enough weapons. Like, even Peyton Pritchard, like, if he needs to take more of an offensive usage, we've seen what he can do with more usage. Boston has enough. Let's go on to the Western Conference and preview 2 of the series out there, starting with the 3-6 series. The Lakers and Timberwolves will face off this weekend. And what is a pretty interesting tactical matchup, because with LA, well, for first I'll start with Anthony Edwards. It's been well reported on throughout the year. He's blitzed more than anybody in pick and rolls. He receives double teams, 2 guys on him a lot of the time. He's talked about it openly, how it can be frustrating and all that. He's gotten better at handling it, I think, over the course of the season. The Lakers, defensively, they don't blitz. They're near the bottom of the league in blitzing and in doubling. They're just more of a switch-heavy team. I wonder if we're going to see the Lakers throw 2 at Ant a lot and try to make everybody else beat them, which is not something that they did a lot during the regular season. What are your expectations there, and what's the top thing that you're watching for when the series ends?
Yeah, I love the call to the blitzing for Anthony Edwards, because I think a lot of what the Lakers have, which is the insane playmaking ability of Luka Doncic, LeBron James, and Austin Reeves, it's just a lot to deal with offensively. On the other side, can Anthony Edwards and Julius Randle manipulate the Lakers' defense and be playmakers? Can those two do the exact same thing on the other side of the ball offensively and create for their teammates? You mentioned Anthony Edwards and his ability to handle switches and well, blitzes mostly. If that falls short, they're going to lean on Julius Randle in the post, high post area, to work and try to create off of, you know, double team situations. If there's a moment where he can put pressure on a Rui Hachimura or on a Dorian Finney-Smith and really force the Lakers to double, and then that's the way the Wolves generate their offense. So I actually think it's a twofold situation where, all right, if they are blitzing Anthony Edwards and getting the ball out of his hands, it's a much more Julius Randle series where you need that guy to be at his best. And we know Randle is a guy who has struggled in the playoffs, 15 games for the Knicks in general, and his shooting percentages are terrible. It's like 37% from the field, 26% from three. So he's really struggled in the moments that he has played in the postseason. This is going to be a huge Randle series because of the amount of pressure that I expect Anthony Edwards to deal with. Also, the Lakers have a lot of functional size. I've kind of tweeted about this, but generally their small ball unit doesn't feel as small as you'd like. Like I kind of tweeted out here, plus 18.6 net rating. And you look at LeBron James, who's a good 6'8". Rui Hachimura, 6'9". Dorian Finney-Smith, 6'8". Luka Doncic is 6'6", 6'7" on a good day. The only guy who's under 6'6" is Austin Reeves. And I think they just do a really good job of recovering out to shooters, of being aggressive without necessarily having to blitz, trying to force turnovers, get out and running. That's the Lakers' way of winning defensively. And I think they can do it against this Wolves team, especially because of the playmaking issues that the Wolves have between Randle and Edwards.
I think Minnesota's going to have to turn that around on the Lakers and use their size to an advantage with Gobert and Randle, Naz Reid. It's going to have to be a huge second chance opportunity series against the smaller Lakers front line. But at the same time, like you can say, well, maybe they get a little bit of an edge on the offensive boards. Well, maybe the Lakers effectively space them out when they have the ball and they're scoring a lot. You can say all of that. But then I look at just pure matchups. Luka shredded Minnesota last year. The functional size you're talking about also includes Luka is huge. LeBron is huge. And Jaden McDaniels, as great as he is defensively, he looked small against Luka last year. He just did. And I worry for Minnesota that, you know, the size advantage we're talking about with them is purely at center, with Rudy Gobert and him, you know, needing to have a big series, lobs, putbacks, offensive board, kickouts, you know, reset the offense or get an open three. But the Lakers are big pretty much everywhere else. Like, they're going to be able to attack Mike Conley as well. I really worry there for Minnesota. I think you nailed it there with that lineup. That's my number one concern for Minnesota and what I think is going to be the number one advantage and really the series deciding factor for the Lakers.
Yeah, the other thing is, you know, the Wolves have a small ball lineup. Like, if Rudy Gobert gets worked off of the floor, right? And there's just, it's not tenable.
Do you see that happening? Do you think he could?
I could see that happening, just because it's something that happened in that Mavericks Wolves series where Luka just kept hunting him. I mean, there's that iconic shot of Luka hitting that shot over Gobert, but it was a part of the series the entire time. Oh, it was incredible. It was the best. But like, that's part of what Luka loves to do.
That's what made Luka cry during the moment. That's what made him cry the hardest, was seeing that exactly on screen. Not all the people working behind the scenes, but screaming at Rudy Gobert. That's what made him really break down.
That meant something. Yeah, that's exactly the type of player Luka is, where he's like, if he finds one single issue with this Wolves team defensively, he's going to poke at it. He's going to go at it. And I think between Gobert and Randle, those are two guys where you can kind of hunt out and mismatch hunt. And the Lakers with LeBron and Luka, they're going to mismatch hunt a ton. They're going to go after those guys. They're going to force the issue. They're going to try to make those guys either get off the floor or for Chris Finch to try and think of something else. And the Wolves, they have a small ball lineup that they go to, which is Dante DiVincenzo, Anthony Edwards, Julius Randle, Naz Reid, and Nikhil Alexander-Walker. They're a plus 11.7 in 188 minutes together. So they have like a formula that's worked for them if they go small, but I just trust the small ball unit of the Lakers a little bit more because of the firepower, because of the fact that you have Luka and LeBron and Reeves, who has been incredible. If Reeves plays like he did in the second half of the season, where he's taking advantage of closeouts, where he's attacking off the bounce, where he's this guy who's basically an incredible isolation scorer and a good pick and roll player, that could be a very, very quick series if Reeves is playing like this. And I think there's a decent chance that that happens, to be honest with you.
I think so too. And, you know, for the Lakers, their amount of go-to scoring depth is more significant than Minnesota's. Yeah. You have Anthony Edwards, who Ant is going to have a big series. Like, he's going to have to shoot threes well, because the Lakers, I would anticipate, they're going to try to crowd the paint. They're going to sag off of some of the shaky or non-shooters on Minnesota. They're going to try to prevent Ant from getting to the basket and force him, you know, to take mid-range jumpers a lot of the time. And with Anthony Edwards, obviously he had an outstanding three-point shooting season, but in this series, I think he's got to find a way to get to the basket as well. And I don't think the Lakers are going to allow that to happen. So it means like Julius Randle's going to have to have a big series. You mentioned his numbers earlier, just how horrible he was in his 15 playoff games for the Knicks. Like, those were his two all NBA seasons, if I remember correctly, right? I think both years that the Knicks made the playoffs were his all NBA seasons, if I remember correctly. And he averaged 17.1 points per game, shot 38.7% from 2-point range, 28.3% from 3-point range. It's just bad numbers. He had a negative assist to turnover ratio as well. So in this series, for Julius Randle, I think less is more. He's going to have to do a little bit less as a scorer, more as a playmaker. But I don't think for Minnesota that's going to end up what's happening. I think they're going to need him to score, but that's part of the problem. You want less is more from Julius Randle, but I think he's going to have to score. And there's been no evidence that he's been able to effectively do that in a postseason setting. And we'll see if it's different for Minnesota. But ultimately, like, I think, you know, for Randle, for Gobert, for Naz Reid, it does kind of circle back to me for the size advantage here. Can Minnesota just be the flat-out bigger team? Like, everything we talked about with Houston Golden State, with Adams and Şengün on the offensive boards, can they just use their size to their advantage over the smaller Golden State team? Is Minnesota going to be able to do that? I don't know because of how the Lakers will be able to exploit those guys on the other end as well. It might turn out that we see that more small ball lineup that you're talking about from Minnesota. And ultimately, I have the Lakers in six in this series. I'll give Minnesota the credit to get two in the series. But, you know, you said it earlier, it could be a quicker series. Are you predicting a quicker series?
I could see Lakers in five, but there's going to be a lot of three-point variance in this series. I'm going to lean with Lakers in six. That's kind of the safe bet here. But the Lakers, since they traded for Luka Doncic, take the third most open looks from three per game, and that's per NBAstats.com. They generate tons of open opportunities because of the way Luka Doncic and LeBron James drive the ball. And so they are going to get a lot of great opportunities from three. Can they capitalize on that? The Wolves, with Anthony Edwards' pull-up shooting ability, Nikhil Alexander-Walker having a great three-point shooting season, Randle generally being a decent knockdown guy, have been top 10 in attempts and top 10 in percentage all season from three-point land. So that variance, I think, can swing the series a little bit, but I agree, just because of the creation ability of the Lakers. And again, it comes down to trusting LeBron and Luka a little bit more than the creators for the Wolves. So I got Lakers in six.
It would be pretty cool to see Anthony Edwards take down Luka and LeBron, though. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, it would. Great revenge game, too. Yeah.
Oh, my God. It would be a revenge game. It would just be, I mean, we'd start the MJ talk again.
Yeah, of course.
It'll come back.
If he has a big game in Los Angeles, where, you know, obviously, you know, Staples Center or crypto, whatever you want to call it, but like that moment would be huge for Anthony Edwards. So I think that's cool. Also, Julius Randle facing off against the team that drafted him, which is, another little wrinkle to this series.
Mm-hmm. I hope we get a super competitive series. I hope we do. Yeah. I hope it's not a quicker series, as you're alluding that it's possible. I don't think it'll be a quick series in favor of Minnesota, but I think it could be a quick series in favor of the Lakers. But ultimately, I think Minnesota's defense is great enough, especially since Gobert got back in March. Yeah. They have one of the best defensive ratings with him on the floor. It's those minutes without Gobert that are really concerning. So if the Lakers can effectively take him off or just minimize his effectiveness, it's going to be a major problem for that Minnesota defense. This isn't the series I'm most excited about, though, in the West. It's the Nuggets and the Clippers. Five series, Denver and LA Clippers starting this weekend. This is the series that I am most fired up about. Clippers have been absolutely unbelievable on both ends of the floor, especially defensively, ever since Kawhi's really turned back into Kawhi. The Nuggets, they get the best player in the world in Nikola Jokic. I know they have some other issues. They just fire their head coach. They get defensive problems, but they still have Jokic. This series is going to be awesome. So what's the number one thing you're watching for in it?
Man, there's so much, because I have like four different things listed here for this Nuggets Clippers series. And to your point, I think this is like probably the best series of the first round, just because of how competitive and back and forth it could be. There's obviously the injury questions for the Clippers in terms of, can Kawhi Leonard stay healthy? Can James Harden stay healthy throughout the series? Can those guys be effective through all seven games? Because I do think this will eventually go seven games, a little, kind of leak to my prediction there. The number one question I have is Jamal Murray, because Murray against the Wolves in the second round last year, 18.4 points per game, shot 40% from the field, 33% from three, 2.7 turnovers per game, which would have been a career high. The Clippers have tons of bodies that they can throw at Murray. They have Derek Jones Jr. They have Chris Dunn. They have Kawhi Leonard. They have Nick Batum potentially, who's going to be coming back for this series. They just have tons of length and physicality to throw out at Jamal Murray. And I think Murray is such a huge part of what the Nuggets do offensively. That two-man game that him and Jokic run is still one of the most unstoppable in the NBA. If the Clippers can effectively limit one aspect of that, which is the Jamal Murray aspect, it really changes the equation for the Nuggets. And Chris Dunn, I don't know how you feel, but man, I wish he was eligible for all defense, because he was just incredible this year. 95th percentile guarding pick and rolls, 87th percentile as an isolation defender. How much the Clippers are allowed to keep him on the floor just because of the lack of three-point shooting threat from him, that's also one aspect that I'm kind of curious about. But generally, Jamal Murray versus the point of attack defense of the Clippers is question number one for me for this series.
Yeah, his effectiveness against their point of attack defense. I'm with you on Chris Dunn, by the way. With Jamal Murray, and not only that, he's just not healthy. Malone, before he got fired, had said it was questionable that he'd be able to return for the postseason, and he ended up playing two games, and he was not good in those games. He shot 25% from three, 45% from two-point range. He just did not look like himself, as we saw prior to that injury, when, like, he got off to a bad start this season, and then middle of the year, February, March, started to look more like Jamal Murray. He looked pretty bad those last two games. Is that going to be more of what we're going to see, especially against a tough Clippers defense on the perimeter? Or is he going to be able to turn into the high scoring Jamal Murray we've seen in some past postseasons, or even last year against the Lakers? He had some not so great games, but then he hit some big shots down the stretch.
Game clutch.
In those games. So, like, that's even in the closing game of that series, I think he had 30 shots almost in the final game.
Yeah.
The Nuggets beat the Lakers last year, and I don't remember it being the most efficient scoring game, but he showed the high volume scoring ability. So that's going to be big time for Denver. Also, I think kind of similar to what you said with the amount of bodies the Clippers have to throw at Jamal Murray, the Nuggets do have some size at the wing. They got Aaron Gordon. Michael Porter's big. He's got these 6'10". I mean, he's not a great defender by any means, but
he's, how big. Are they, yeah,
like, he's big. Yeah. How are they going to do against Kawhi Leonard, who has just been absolutely sensational? The way Kawhi's moving right now, he looks like peak Kawhi at the moment. Defensively, the way he's roaming around and rotating. Offensively, the way he's getting into his shots, getting to the basket. Kawhi Leonard looks like a top five player at this particular moment. And for the Nuggets, do they have enough bodies to contain him? And even if you do somehow, some way, well, they got James Harden. They got Norm Powell. They got Zubats, who's really freaking good. I had him on my third team All-NBA. I just feel like the Clippers got more guys that can be trusted behind their best player, Kawhi Leonard, than the Nuggets do behind their best player, Nikola Jokic.
Yeah, I agree with you that the Clippers have those guys. The Nuggets, you know, wasn't it a thing that they got Aaron Gordon to guard Kawhi? Like, that was the primary aspect they eventually traded for him in the first place. So now they're finally getting to see if that comes to fruition. Like, Gordon is a really, really important part of this piece. Offensively, obviously, the two-man game between him and Jokic, but defensively, being the primary defender on Kawhi Leonard, I think he has the size, he has the strength, he has the foot speed to be able to keep along with Kawhi. The way that Kawhi is able to just not waste any steps offensively, that's something that obviously from covering the Raptors and watching him in 2019, he's just such a surgical offensive player, and that hasn't changed. He just knows his spots. He's effective. And I think he's like in a playoff series, fully healthy. I don't think you can take five players over him in the NBA. Like, that's, he's one of the most effective playoff players that we have currently in the NBA. The other thing is that on the other side, the Nuggets have Nikola Jokic, who is equally in that regard, an incredible playoff player. And I guess the question I have is kind of the push and pull between Jokic manipulating the Clippers defense and how great the Clippers defense is at recovering out and getting, you know, kind of stopping these advantages that Jokic is able to create out of thin air. You think of the three-point rate for the Nuggets and them not being the greatest three-point shooting team, tons of pressure on Michael Porter Jr., tons of pressure on Jamal Murray to knock down those shots. Christian Brown is another guy who I think is important in this series. Can the Nuggets get out in transition? That's going to come down to how well the Nuggets defend. And Kevin, I guess I'll ask you this. This is something that I'm worried about, or I guess concerned about. Jokic isn't having the greatest defensive season. And how much pressure will the Clippers put on Jokic to work on the defensive end? Because Zubats has been great in post-ups. I think he'll be able to put some pressure on Jokic. And generally, getting Jokic involved in pick and rolls, how high will Jokic be on the level of the screen pick and roll wise? Will it be a situation where he has to step up higher because it's Kawhi Leonard or James Harden who can knock down those threes? Or will he play a deeper drop and hope that, you know, his point of attack defenders can kind of go over those screens and fight through? That's sort of the push and pull between how great Jokic is offensively and how he can manipulate the Clippers defense versus how much pressure can the Clippers offense put on Jokic on the defensive end.
I think that's spot on, and we're going to see that probably right out of the gates in game one. Like, they're going to be attacking Jokic over and over, trying to wear him down. And offensively, Jokic needs to carry more of a load than he ever has. I mean, he had an all-time great offensive season. He was like, he might win MVP. I voted for SGA, but it was very, very close. It was razor thin for me between Jokic and SGA, because Jokic was just that spectacular this year. And there's no way the Nuggets are even sniffing the playoffs if it's not for him, his greatness on the offensive end. But defensively, you're right. He wasn't the same this year, and that's in part because of the load he had to carry offensively. Can he elevate his play to some prior levels as a rim protector, as a guy using his quick hands in the passing lanes? And he still did get a lot of steals this season, but even more so effective. And can the Clippers have enough ball movement to exploit some of the Nuggets' defensive issues as well? That's part of a one question I have for the Clippers in this series. But ultimately, I think for Denver, they just don't have enough defensively. Jamal Murray's health, I feel so little confidence. If he's healthy, maybe my prediction would change. But ultimately, without him being looking healthy, I have a hard time picking Denver in the series. I think for the Clippers, I'd pick them to win the series. I don't feel great about Denver, but I am curious about, you know, we're talking like Denver concerns a lot. Do you have a top concern on your mind for the Clippers side of things? Besides,
yeah, Kawhi's they go through
health.
These.
Besides that. Yeah.
That's the obvious one. And I think that's yes. the one where that I'm kind of skeptical of like actually picking the Clippers in the series just because of that. But to your point about the playmaking and the ball movement, they do stall out offensively a little bit. They lean on their isolation scoring a lot between Harden, between Kawhi, Norm Powell, who can kind of attack tilted defenses, and then Zubats in the post. So like there's not a lot of ball movement there other than James Harden. Can the Nuggets, just by staying home, just by trusting their one-on-one defenders, limit the Clippers offensively, not get out in rotation more often, and then that way they create an advantage for themselves? That's the way I've seen the Clippers go through offensive droughts this season because of that, and I think that's one of the questions that I have for this Clippers team. I'm going to go Nuggets in six. I think just because of the Kawhi Leonard of it all, the questions about his health. I love Kawhi as a basketball player. Absolutely love him. Watched him dominate for the 2019 Toronto Raptors. And then for the Clippers throughout the, you know, last 5 years, every single time it's been something in the playoffs. And I hate that it's been the case. I really do hate that it's been the case that we can't rely on Kawhi in the postseason. I hope that's not what happens in this series. I really do. But if you're a betting person, you're kind of betting on the fact that this is what's going to happen. So I'm going to go ahead and say Nuggets in six. I also think there is something to the fact that Jokic is the best player in the world. And when you have the best player in the world in a playoff series, you just have an advantage. That's just the very simple truth. And with Kawhi, the injuries, I just don't know, man. I don't trust it, Kevin. I don't know.
I know. Maybe I'm just getting hoodwinked by Kawhi looking excellent.
He's been awesome.
He's been unbelievable. He's been
unbelievable.
And maybe this is the year. Maybe this is the year he stays healthy.
You said April that for and May. 5 years, man. I don't know, man. I can't. You know,
fool but he load wants, managed. Fool I know he load managed more than ever this year, more than ever.
So, yeah, look, if Kawhi stays healthy, sure, I believe in your prediction, Clippers and six. But I would be dumb. I would be dumb. I can't. I don't know, man. It doesn't work.
I mean, it's partially that with Kawhi, but also Harden is playing unbelievable basketball all year long. Early in the year, no Kawhi Leonard, James Harden. He plays a higher usage than he has in years, carrying that offense, helping them stay afloat while their defense was dominant and helped them win games. Kawhi comes back. He's been pushed more off ball, a little bit more often, playing, just picking his spots, playing an efficient style, shooting like 50% from, you know, in floater range. He's been Harden's been awesome. And so I think with the Clippers, they just have so many weapons and elite defense. I'm taking them in six in the series. But I hope it goes seven. I hope this isn't, you know, a down-the-wire series. It'd be so great if we get that between, you know, some of the greatest players in the game today, especially with one of the greatest of all time in Jokic. Let's close today's show, S, with talking about a little bit of the latest news that came out. Nico Harrison said some more stupid stuff. God. At his presser. I mean, so for a guy that, you know, doubled and tripled and quadrupled down on the fact that, hey, defense wins championships, for a guy so confident in his beliefs and the decision to trade Luka for Anthony Davis, they have a private media session with no cameras, no audio recording. Your actions speak louder than your words, I'd say, in this case. What was your reaction when you saw that news come out that there's no cameras, no audio recordings allowed for Nico's, you know, goodbye presser?
How is it possible that the Mavs keep making this worse is my question. They obviously made one of the most ridiculous trades in NBA history, probably goes down as one of the worst trades in sports history. And they continue on this 2-month long thing where they take shots at Luka in the media, where they go ahead and justify what they did because of, again, defense wins championships, even though they went to the NBA Finals last year. And they go ahead and still do a tribute video and all that type of stuff. They're trying to make up for the fact that they did 2 months of slandering the guy who basically led them to a finals run. And now you have a situation where they did this media press tour with nobody. I think that's the thing that's the wildest part to me, is they did a closed door media session like it was a movie, like they thought that they could get away with something or maybe keep the narrative to whatever it was. I'm not sure exactly why they decided to do a closed door media session. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But some of the quotes that are coming out from that, like the defense wins championship thing. The other thing was, I believe it was ESPN's Tim McMahon who asked about the Supermax. And, you know, Nico Harrison was like, oh, yeah, we have no guarantee that he was going to, you know, sign the Supermax. And Tim McMahon is like, he said he was going to sign the Supermax. And he's like, yeah, we had no guarantee. It's like, man, nobody is going to not take an extra $100 million of money, man. That's just not possible. I'm sorry. But yeah, just terrible excuses, terrible excuses, man.
When I saw that, I did a podcast with Jason Gallagher, who works with Old Man and the Three and Mind the Game with LeBron show. Gallagher, huge, you know, Mavericks fan, not so much anymore, I guess, you know, because of what happened. But Jason and I role played as Nico Harrison on my podcast. It was like a day or two after the trade. I'm like, this is why we did it. We didn't know he was going to sign.
Yeah.
And Jason's like, you sound a lot more logical than the real Nico. You sound a hell of a lot more logical with your decision making here. It's like Nico listened to the podcast. He's like, that sounds like a pretty good reason. I'm going to say that. Granted, you have this reporter that did a whole freaking book on Luka and Tim McMahon.
Oh, my God.
That definitely spoke a hell of a lot to Luka and has a lot of inside sources on what Luka was going to do. I just can't believe it. I can't believe it. They keep making this worse. You said it, S.
Yeah.
They keep making it worse. Even like go back at the first game without him, they blur out Luka and like they cover him up with Mavericks logos. Like every decision at every level of the organization with the social stuff, the PR team with the behind closed doors, Nico speaking out of his ass, like every choice is making it worse. And I feel bad for Mavericks fans. It's been months, and granted, you wouldn't be over this loss in months. You're never going to get over this loss as a Mavericks fan, but it keeps bringing you back to that moment with these bad decisions. And they can talk all they want about, you know, Cuban had a quote about, oh, you still need to root for these players. It's not their fault. Of course it's not their fault, but it is the fault of the guy who makes the decisions when he's saying, you know, I work on behalf of the Dallas Mavericks, not Dirk Nowitzki. It's like, Dirk is the Dallas Mavericks. He's what made them in part who they are, with his loyalty and his play, sticking it out there and turning into the player that he did through some early lumps and early ups and downs. Dirk is part of what defines what the Dallas Mavericks are. And you come in and you change all that. And then you double down, triple down, quadruple down, sextuple down. I don't know, octuple down. I don't know how far it goes.
It hurts me, and it should hurt a lot of NBA fans that this is the way that it went down, because I just think it's the most bizarre story in the NBA. Where people probably are wondering how much longer we're going to talk about this Luka Doncic trade. A very long time, just because
when's the NBA gonna make them change the conversation and bring in their new Colangelo? Like you did it with Sam Hinkie and the Sixers. Yeah. We're going to talk about it then. That seems inevitable at some point.
That's a good question. Do you think that if the Mavs this summer decided, okay, we're going to fire Nico Harrison, is that enough from a Mavs fan perspective to move on? Because he made one of the worst trades in NBA history, maybe the worst trade in NBA history. And then for him to get fired 4 months later, it feels like it's too little too late. I don't know.
You gotta, it's a bad breakup. You gotta get rid of Nico. You gotta trade AD. You gotta trade Max Christie. You gotta get rid of Jason Kidd. Everybody that reminds you of that trade. Delete all the pictures. Get rid of all. It's that type of breakup. You need a completely clean slate. That's what the Mavericks need. That's what I think they need. Do you agree with me there?
Yeah, I agree, man. I agree. Just completely start something new. Just whatever it is that you have to do to get over this. I don't know, man. Like, how much longer are these Fire Nico chants going to happen? How much longer will the Mavs just go ahead and deal with them? And then from the ownership's perspective, like, it just doesn't seem like Patrick Dumont or, you know, just from the quotes that we're seeing from some of the reporting around this trade, doesn't seem like there is a clear, concise basketball direction other than defense wins championships. And we thought we'd have a better chance of winning a championship, which is objectively incorrect here when it comes to trading Luka Doncic for Anthony Davis and all those guys. It's just still bizarre, still very bizarre. And now you get to watch Luka in the playoffs for the Lakers. That's the thing that the Mavs fans are going to have to deal with. Tough.
Two last things. Joe Dumars is in all likelihood going to be hired to run Pelicans basketball of operations, according to Shams Charania. Dumars hasn't been a GM for many years now, but did have some success in the early 2000s with the Pistons. He's recently been working for the NBA. The interesting news from yesterday came from Shamit Dua, and he said that he's heard some stuff about how Zion could be potentially a guy that gets moved under Dumars. Do you think that's the right decision here for New Orleans to move forward without Zion? And do you expect that they could get anything really great in return anyway for somebody like Zion with how injury prone he is?
I'm curious to see what his value is around the league because his contract is really interesting. There's a bunch of non-guarantees in his contract based on games played situations, based on there's actually a weight stipulation there too that he has to hit a certain weight for some of his deal and his money to get guaranteed. So I'm not sure how front offices value a contract that has tons of non-guaranteed money versus some guaranteed money for a player who, like, when Zion Williamson is healthy, is an incredible basketball player, one of the most entertaining players to watch, can rise up to like a top 10, top 15 level player when he's healthy. It's just that he's never healthy. And, you know, 30 games this season, has barely been able to put together a full season in his career so far. I'm curious to see if another front office says, hey, we'll take the risk here because of the interesting structure of his contract, what kind of value that brings back. I'm not necessarily sure if there's any type of value that'll come back from there, but it's more about the Pelicans starting new. They get a lottery pick too, KOC. Like, I think that's the other thing. If you land in the top three and you're looking at like a Dylan Harper or maybe even Cooper Flagg, if they land number one, that really changes things and it makes more sense for them to move Zion then.
Yeah, you know, I'm really split on trading Zion because on one hand, everything you said, he's got weight clauses in his contract for a reason. He hasn't stayed healthy. He's, you know, he has his flaws. Like, he's a great player when he's on the floor, but he doesn't shoot. He's a shaky defender as well. There's like real flaws in his game that could really manifest in a postseason, but we haven't seen him in those settings because of his injury prone nature. And so, you know, Windhorst said how, you know, he didn't say straight out that they're going to trade Zion or anything like that, but he said they're going to have candid conversations. They're going to have a sit down. I believe Sham said on NBA Today yesterday, like, I think it depends on the offer. Honestly, like, is a team willing to make something that's a strong offer for him, a lottery pick, maybe a young player? If it's just a salary dump, no, I'm keeping Zion. I'm not just getting rid of him. He's not, to me, the level of player. I'm just cleaning my hands of Zion Williamson. It's not like Bradley Beal wanting to stretch his contract with the Suns where, get the hell out of here. With Zion, there's still something there. There's still something there with him. We saw it this season. He was awesome in the second half of the year. So there's still something. So I wouldn't want to just get rid of him. I don't know what team. Like, Windhorst also said there's going to be significant interest if he were put on the trade market. He said that back in March. I don't know where the significant interest is going to be. Like, Brooklyn?
Yeah, from who?
Brooklyn?
Yeah.
From Brooklyn, a team like that. Anybody come to mind for you that is a team that should, you know, make a really strong offer for Zion?
What about the Miami Heat? A little bit of Heat culture for Zion Williamson? How do you feel about that? Like, if there's one team that kind of can set them on the right path, and they do go for their stars, you know, they do like trading for their stars. They like getting involved in those type of deals. if it's not, if you have to maybe, they now have two first round picks in this draft because of the Jimmy Butler trade. Maybe they give up one of those picks. They're probably going to end up in the lottery here. I'm not sure what it'll end up being. Maybe. Yeah. Miami. How do you feel about that?
Yeah. Miami's intriguing. Nah. Yeah, they could use a swing. Yeah. They could use a swing. I mean, I think it would be a team like that. I think it would be a team,
you know,
like Chicago, their opponent in the play-in, like somebody like that, where it's like you're kind of on the fringes, you know, like Atlanta, like one of those like play-in level teams. How about your Raptors?
Yeah, I can't. I don't know, man. It'd just be funny to trade for both Brandon Ingram and Zion Williamson, wouldn't it? It just be like, the New Orleans Raptors here. That just would
another tanking year.
Yeah, yeah. Make sure those guys will play a total of 50 games combined. But yeah, I don't know. I don't see it for the Raptors. Maybe what about the Kings? I just thought of this, but like another team on the fringes.
Teams like that, just the Kings, Mavericks, like these teams that are kind of on the bubble, or even the Suns, like at a three-way trade type of thing. Durant goes somewhere, you get Zion back, and you just roll the dice. You roll the dice that Zion stays healthy moving forward in his career. Teams like that, we'll see. I mean, I'm sure more stuff will come out about Zion. Last thing here, Damian Lillard is going to miss the start of the postseason between the series with the Bucks and the Pacers. Do you think this is, if he misses the entire series, do you think this is a series killer for the Bucks against the Pacers?
I don't think it's a series killer. Look, obviously Dame is a huge part of what the Bucks do, but I do think that they can pose some challenges for the Pacers regardless, just because Giannis is Giannis, and there's not really anybody on that team, on the Pacers, that can guard Giannis in any significant way. So Indiana is going to have to send tons of bodies. And then it's on the Bucks shooters. Can AJ Green knock down 40% of his looks? Can Gary Trent Jr. knock down 40% of his looks? Obviously, Dame would have helped in that regard too. So I think if Dame played, I would be more confident in the Bucks winning this series. No Dame makes it so that I lean Indiana, but I would not be surprised if the Bucks, just because of an incredible Giannis playoff series, end up pulling off the upset.
Going to do a full preview of the Bucks and Pacers on Friday's episode. We'll be back then. S, this is great, man. Thanks for joining me today.
Yes, sir. Appreciate you, man. Thank you for having me on.
Where can everybody find your stuff?
Yeah, go listen to the Athletic NBA Daily with myself, Dave Dufour, Zena Cato. We do a lot of recapping and kind of talking about the NBA on a daily basis. It's called that. But that's it. And if you like the Raptors, if you like to follow the Raptors, Raptors Republic, follow me on Twitter, et cetera, all that jazz. Yeah.
Appreciate you joining me today, S.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Big thank you again to S. Barahini for joining me on today's episode. Thanks to Mike, Emmy, and the whole team for producing it. And thanks to you for giving us a listen. Please subscribe if you have not done so already and give us a 5-star rating. Really does help out the show, especially with the playoffs coming right now. Hope you have a great rest of your week. Enjoy the play-in games. We got the playoffs coming this weekend, coming soon.